So that sort of allow you to connect things in supersymmetric H theory with algebraic geometry, which is a very useful translational tool for these statements that a recovered space is available to engage theory of higher dimensions. Recovered space is available to engage theory in higher dimensions can be described as in terms of moduli Eppingtons, all this kind of stuff. So today I want to give more examples of these kinds of calculations. So because I think you guys will be able to do this kind of thing by yourselves. So an example I wanted to discuss is the relationship between seven-dimensional maximally supersymmetric H theory and Donaldson-Thomas invariants. And it's going to be related to K-theoretic Donaldson-Thomas invariants. So we saw what these twists of these gauge theories look like on flat space. The twist of the seven-dimensional gauge theory is one of these funny Chern-Simons theories we were discussing on a manifold, which is C3/1 times OR. So there's always some holomorphic directions, some topological directions, and some odd directions. So the fields are it's something the Dalbo form in these directions, the Durand form in these directions, and then there's an odd variable, and then with coefficients in some Lie algebra with a shift of one. And the action function is this kind of Chern-Simons action. Okay. So let's replace C3 by some other Calabi-Yau manifold, and we're going to try and figure out what the Hilbert space is. So suppose we take X Calabi-Yau threefold. We'll do the same theory. We ask, what's the Hilbert space? Although I suppose before I go on, I mean, how are people feeling about? I feel like I moved pretty quickly to this rather abstract formalism. I'm worried it's losing people. Any thoughts? No. So to understand the Hilbert space, so the first thing we need to understand the phase space. So the phase space, by definition of any theory, is equal to the space of solutions the equations of motion on a small interval. So in this example, on x times a small interval. And the phase space is always a symplectic manifold. For a physical theory, if you give me an honest physical scalar field theory, in dimensions bigger than one, the phase space will be infinite dimensional. But for many these partially twisted examples, the phase space will be finite dimensional. As an example, the phase space of Chern-Simons theory is a space of flat G bundles on a Riemann surface, which is a symplectic manifold. We'll find something similar here. OK, so what's the phase space? So to understand how to do this, well, if we have a theory, an ordinary scalar field theory with an action functional involving two derivatives, then the phase space would involve the value of your scalar field and its first derivative. But here, the action functional only involves one derivative. So if you think about it, you'll realize we can understand the phase space by thinking about those fields which are just independent of time. So the phase space is equal to the solutions to the equations of motion, which are independent of t and dt. So that means we can just, to understand the phase space, we just get rid of this factor involving OR. Yeah?
If we specify some boundary conditions for the field on x,
yes.
Do we get a unique solution to the equation of motion on x times r?
Yes.
Is that always true, or is it something special?
A point in the phase space is the Cauchy data for the PDE. That's always true because the phase. So in general, how would you understand the phase space? You would look at you do expansion in a series in T, and then you look at the equations, and you would see that the first two terms in that expansion determine the rest of them. So it's always true that a point in the phase space can be extended uniquely to a series in T, satisfying the equations. And typically to something, some finite region. Okay, so what is the phase space? So if we write in this kind of fancy BVified world with all these crazy fields, we're looking at we have phi. Epsilon, insert GLN, insert E, shift of 1, satisfying some equation. Which I'll write down in a second. But we can kind of unravel this a little bit and make it more explicit. So if we assume that epsilon is of degree minus 1, then the degree 0 part is something in connection, 0, 1 form, together with some other field, like, I don't know, I'll call it with B, omega 0, 2, will be a fine word. Yeah. And this comes from the coefficient of epsilon. So these are just the degree zero fields. Because of this shift of one, without the epsilon, we have a 0-1 form. So this is, because epsilon is of degree minus 1, the epsilon piece has a shift of 2, so we get a 0-2 form as the degree zero fields. So we have these two guys, which satisfy while this guy must have the 0-2 component of its curvature vanish. And also, this must be holomorphic. But of course, there's gauge transformations. Modulo gauge. The usual gauge transformation for A. And B transforms is a 0-2 form, but there's also an extra one. B goes to B plus B bar theta. Theta is a 0-1 form. In fact, if you work, there's also a secondary gauge transformation for eta. So you can check, you know, this equation is unchanged if I add on B bar, so this should be. If I add on something like this, this will preserve these equations. So my field space is these fields modulo those equations. So what is this? What are we describing? That A part, well, since F02 of A is 0, this is describing a holomorphic bundle. And the B part, well, because of this equation and this gauge transformation, it's an element of the second Dalbach cohomology group of X with coefficients in the adjoint bundle. If you think about this, this is the cotangent bundle to the space of holomorphic bundles. Let me see why that is. Is it visible up there? Yeah? Model space of bundles on X, because at a particular bundle, the tangent space at this bundle, what are the deformations I can do of a holomorphic bundle up to gauge? I can add on something to the 0-1 form, and it has to satisfy the D bar equation, and then there's modulo some gauge transformations. So this is just the first Dalbach cohomology group. In the adjoint bundle. And this is a dual by Sergio Algi. To the second one. And we're using it in an essential way that the canonical bundle of X is trivial. Okay. Great, so now any questions about this computation? Okay. So, and if you're a little pedantic, well, not pedantic, but careful, you might worry, but you know, well, what about all the other anti-fields and so on and all that stuff? But it turns out that's nicely taken care of by the language of derived algebraic geometry. Derived algebraic geometry is a version of algebraic geometry in which there are some fermionic coordinates. And there's derived moduli spaces. They match up nicely with the rest of the fields. OK, so how does this help us calculate the Hilbert space? What this shows for us is that this shows is that if we take 7D gauge theory, on x times r, and we compactify an x, it becomes quantum mechanics on this space. The cotangent bundle of the moduli of G bundles on x. So what's the Hilbert space? We can do usual quantization. One word of caution, we have to treat this as a holomorphic symplectic manifold. So we're doing holomorphic quantization. The Hilbert space is the Dalbow cohomology of this space of G bundles with coefficients in the square root of the canonical bundle. Okay? In the world of real geometry, if I have a cotangent bundle, between quantum mechanics and a cotangent bundle, the Hilbert space is L2 functions on the base twisted by half densities. In the holomorphic world, we do the same thing. Hilbert spaces have holomorphic functions in the base, if I'm taking Dalbow cohomology, twisted by square root of the canonical bundle. OK.
Well, yeah? Why is it the cohomology?
Pardon?
Why is it the cohomology and not just all L2 functions?
And not just the
all L2 functions on bundle?
Yeah. The reason is that from the beginning, we started with our space of fields of the supersymmetric gauge theory. And to do all this twisting stuff in Euclidean signature, to have supersymmetry, we need to complexify our space of fields. Because in Euclidean signature, the spin representations are not real, they're complex. So what we've done, we've complexified our space of fields. And that's why this space here is some complexified version of the original space of fields. Our action function was a holomorphic function on it. And that the supersymmetry operator involved the Dalbow differential on this space. So
maybe like the supersymmetric part of the Hilbert space?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You could think of it like I think some details got a bit erased in the way we calculated stuff. But like in the original physical theory, the Hilbert space might look like the Dalbow complex of this thing. And the operators, which generate supersymmetry, will be d bar and d bar star. And I suppose we should be able to calculate that that has the correct amount of supersymmetry, right? Yeah. N equals 2 quantum mechanics, which is, yeah, we started with 8 of supercharges compactified on Clavier that broke. Break it down. Okay. Wait, so what's the partition function? The partition function is going to be the Euler characteristic of this. So what's the partition function of the theory on x cross S1? It's equal to the Euler characteristic of this. So from a certain point of view, it's tautological that this order characteristic is the k-theoretic version of the Donaldson-Thomas invariance. We can also use the index theorem or the Riemann-Roch theorem. Say by Riemann-Roch, we find that the partition function on x cross S1 is equal to the interval on G of the top class this turns out to be zero. So you can also think of this as the A hat class. For example, you know, you might, there's like a bunch of pretty subtle issues with compactification, you know, allowing your G bundles to acquire some singularities to make the moduli of G bundles compact. At this level of analysis, we're not going to be able to see that very clearly. But you know, one can imagine a situation in which this moduli space, the virtual dimension is zero, so if everything was really nice, there might actually be finitely many of these guys for each topological class, and this partition function just literally counts how many there are with multiples. Okay. Okay, so any questions about this kind of thing? Okay, so for me, the utility of this is that you can do some kind of translation, you know. You can do some kind of translation between string theory and algebraic knowledge. You can check things in string theory by doing calculations in DT invariance, and these kinds of arguments allow you to go back and forth. So to go further, so we've understood all maximally supersymmetric theories, which have 16 supercharges. And these theories can't have any matter. It's also useful to understand the theories which have 8 supercharges and have matter. They can be described in similar ways, and we can do similar calculations. And for example, we might be able to arrive at some of the things Davide was talking about when he gave a seminar in the math seminar a couple of weeks ago about boundary conditions for 3D n equals 4 theories by way of this analysis. So let me describe a little bit about that. Okay, so we have 8 supercharges in whatever dimension you're in. Then to give a theory, we need Lie algebra, our group, and normally, people would say a hyperkähler representation, but we're working in a more complex world, so I'll just say a complex symplectic representation. So the 16 supercharged version is the special case where this guy is the cotangent bundle G. So this G plus G star. So we're going to use a slightly funny trick to describe these theories with eight supercharges. And the trick is, from the Lie algebra and a symplectic representation, we'll construct a new Lie algebra. Given G, V, we let G sub V be a graded Lie algebra. Where in degree 0, it's G, degree 1, it's V, and degree 2, it's G star. And it has the following Lie brackets. Call this an element, say X, V, and X star. So bracket of X with anything is equal to the action of G on everything. And the only other non-zero brackets, despite for degree reasons, the only other possibility for a non-zero bracket is I can take two guys here and produce something in here. And that bracket is, I take two elements here, well, that's going to be the moment map. Or the moment map from V, V star, this is a quadratic function. Okay. Notice the moment map, it's quadratic, so these partial derivatives commute. But that's what you want. These are odd elements, so you expect the Lie bracket to be a symmetric quantity. Right, but two odd elements, you know, because of the Cauchy rule of signs, when I move these guys past each other, there's a big commute. Okay. This is a slightly funny construction. But to justify it, let's make the following observation. So we say an element. I give you an element of degree 1, we say that alpha satisfies the Markov-Hahn equation if alpha alpha equals 0. In fact, this is something you can do for any graded Lie algebra. You can consider the Markov-Hahn equation. The equation that alpha brackets with itself is 0. In this case, well, if it was a differential graded Lie algebra, there would be another term, d alpha plus half of alpha alpha equals 0. Because there's no differential, we're not including that term. In this case, some element alpha in V, this is the degree 1 elements, satisfies Markov-Hahn, if and only if alpha is in the zero locus of the moment map. Okay. Now, in any graded Lie algebra, as kind of standard construction for a bunch of reasons, is that you can take the set of Mark-Cartan solutions of the Mark-Cartan equation and divide them by the degree zero elements, which act. So the elements say chi, degree zero, act as symmetries of a set of Mark-Cartan solutions. They're often called gauge symmetries. Then the ascending alpha goes to alpha plus epsilon I alpha, where epsilon is a parameter of square zero. So what happens in this case? This is, again, another kind of standard construction one does. Mark-Cartan solutions modulo gauge symmetry. In this case, Mark-Cartan solutions mod gauge symmetry mod gauge. This is equal to the symplectic reduction. Okay, so I think this, your seminar, for, there was some mistake with the scheduling.
Oh, I see.
And I just got an email. I had a, your seminar disappeared from the calendar and they scheduled my class here instead.
Oh, I see. Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
And just for this week, you guys are somewhere else and next week I'm somewhere else. Yeah, there was some mistake with the portal.
Okay, thanks for this. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you want to use this to describe theories with 8 superchargeds. So the highest dimension they can live is 6. So the following theorem. If I take n equals 1 gauge theory, in 6 dimensions, and matter in V is the theory after twisting whose fields are in the Dalbow complex, say C3, tensor G of V with the shift of 1, and the action functional where this Lie algebra, you notice, has a certain invariant pairing. the algebra, which is of degree minus 2. So I forgot to write the pairings. I'll write it right now. So. The pairing is the obvious thing. This pairs with itself by the symmetric form, and these two pair together. So another way to describe this theory, is that it's holomorphic Rosansky-Witten theory. So Rosansky-Witten theory wrote down a certain topological field theory in three dimensions. And this is kind of a gauged holomorphic version of it. OK, so to get a feeling for this, we can understand what the solutions of the equations of motion are, caveat threefold. We have some caveat threefold. So what are the solutions to the equations of motion? Well, let's start with the case. Well, let's just write it out. So the answer is we'll have, remember the fields are going to look like this. G, degree minus 1, V, degree 0, V star. So I'm going to be sloppy about some point, but the answer I'll give you will be essentially correct. So the piece from G, we will find a holomorphic G bundle on X. The V part is that this will give rise to a section phi of the associated G bundle. And this must be holomorphic. But there's another term, and if you think about what the equations of motion coming from varying in these fields give rise to, we will realize, or another way to say it, the equations of motion will be the Markarton equations. The Markarton equations we've already seen involve the moment map being zero. We'll also find that phi is equal to zero as a section of the moment map of phi to phi is equal to zero. This is the section. So in other words, what is it If we take some extreme case, where we look at some open subset of V, where G has no stabilizer, what are we finding? We're finding a holomorphic map to the symplectic reduction. Because when there's no stabilizer, this is a way of describing that. But in the locus, when phi is 0, if phi requires some stabilizer, then we can have some additional gauge field, and run, you know, some Coulomb branch breaks off. I said that very poorly, but let me write that about it again. So, suppose we have some open set where which is preserved by G, and has no stabilizer, where G acts freely. So if the scalar field lands in U, then there's some open subset of the solutions of the equations of motion. Solutions to the equations of motion are simply the same as holomorphic maps from X to the symplectic reduction. So this is really how you should think about it. You can think about this as the Higgs branch of the theory, the symplectic reduction. But of course, there's going to be points where the symplectic reduction is badly behaved because there's stabilizers, and then other things will happen. It's more complicated. Okay, maybe in the last few minutes, I think there's like a bunch of fun things you can do with this. You can, we give this analysis at the beginning, like why does seven-dimensional gauge theory related to DT invariants? You can do something entirely similar by taking this theory, reducing it to five dimensions, and seeing, by studying the Hilbert space, you'll find it's related to the moduli of instantons, and that the partition function will be related to the k-theoretic Donaldson invariants, or the k-theoretic Nekrasov partition function. So that's very similar analysis to what we said at the beginning will lead to that. But something slightly more topical might be we can also reduce to three dimensions. We reduce the story to three dimensions, we'll find we're studying 3D n equals 4 gauge theories. And these are the theories which are relevant for mirror symmetry, three-dimensional mirror symmetry. We'll be able to see a little bit about that. If we reduce to 3D, well, we're always going to find that the arguments we gave earlier for reductions will apply in these cases too. You know, before we saw if we reduce from C5 lower dimensions, we find the same kind of theory, but with a super manifold or some real directions. That's what we find here. If we reduce to three dimensions, we find the same kind of theory, but built from, instead of C3, we'll find C1/1 plus R and this super Lie algebra. It's weighted Lie algebra. So, in other words, the fields are so this is a twist. Of 3D n equals 4 theory. So in this story of 3D n equals 4 mirror symmetry, people studied two different topological twists. And these two topological twists are interchanged by mirror symmetry. This is just like what happens in the more famous example of two-dimensional mirror symmetry. There's two twists of the n equals 2.2 model, which are interchanged by mirror symmetry. So we can see the two twists here by thinking about the remaining supersymmetry. The remaining supersymmetry is given by, just like before, it's given by the odd vector fields. Epsilon delta z and del epsilon on C1/1. Clearly these commute to d by dz, so they form a supersymmetry algebra. So epsilon delta z will lead to what we might call the Rozanski-Witten twist. And this one leads to the twisted terminology is absolutely appalling, and I'm not sure. I think Davide, I blame Davide for that one. There should be better terminology. I think this is like the B model. This one is like the A model. And these are interchanged by mirror symmetry. Okay, so we can see some really basic aspects of the story by looking at which operators are supersymmetric for these two twists. So let's start with the case that the Lie algebra is zero. So the theory is free. So the fundamental field is just some V is a symplectic vector space. And this satisfies the equations of motion. What are the operators we can build from this guy? So what typically happens in these things, you know, any direction you have a Durand complex, you can't build any derivatives in that direction, because derivatives will be BRST exact. Any direction you have a Delbow complex, sorry, I forgot the epsilon. When you have a Delbow complex, you can't build any Z bar derivatives, because they will be BRST exact. So the operators we can build So if we expand phi is like phi naught plus epsilon phi 1, the operators we can build are functions of I can take some derivative of phi naught at some point and some derivative phi 1 at some point. These are bosonic. These are fermionic. How does the supersymmetry act? We have epsilon d by dz and d by d epsilon. So the epsilon d by dz operator, well, it takes the field phi naught to the field phi 1, the next derivative. So how it will act on operators, it will go the other way. So it sends delta z decay phi 1, 0, to the operator dk plus 1. And del epsilon sends just by thinking about these act in the fields in the obvious way, and we deduce how they act in the functions on the fields. Del epsilon, there's no cohomology. There are no operators. Every operator invariant under this guy is exact. Whereas epsilon del z, the quantity invariant operators, everything built from phi 0 is invariant, but those which involve any z derivative are exact. So only this one survives in cohomology. So since this is the Rozanski-Witten twist, we deduced that the space of local operators is equal to the symmetric algebra of V star. So more generally, when there's a gauge group, then operators in the Rozanski-Witten twist by the same kind of argument are going to be holomorphic functions on the symplectic reduction. So this symplectic reduction is called the Higgs branch. And we've kind of sketched why, kind of from first principles, why operators in the Rozanski-Witten twist are precisely the functions on the Higgs branch. It's one of the standards. Now, the story gets really interesting when you try to think about operators where you can allow the field to have some class of singularities. That leads to the much, much more subtle algebra of operators in the Coulomb branch studied by Braverman. Okay, so we'll stop there for now.